Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Aletheia Church, Boston. Aletheia exists to bring the truth, grace, and changing power of the gospel for the glory of God and the good of all people. For more information, visit aletheia.org.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for your giving and for filling out those cards. We super appreciate it. We really, really love to pray over those every Monday morning as a staff, and so those are really great. We are in the fourth week of a teaching series in the book of Romans, and so if you have a Bible, you can go ahead and open it to the book of Romans, and we'll begin reading in the third chapter today. Just by way of review, as we've come this far, the book of Romans starts off with a bang. We learned in our first sermon that Paul is really excited about the gospel, and he's so thrilled about what Jesus has done that he's happily describing himself as a slave of Jesus and a preacher of the gospel, because according to him, it's the power of God to save anyone who believes. And in this thing called the gospel, which we're going to unpack for the next many, many chapters and many, many more weeks, this gospel thing is God's righteousness put on cosmic display. And so that was really exciting, and it was especially exciting considering what's currently on display. What's currently on display is not God's righteousness. According to Paul, the very next thing that we learn is that God's wrath is actually what we seem to experience quite a bit of. And it's not the cartoonish wrath of, you know, a bunch of devils with pokers kind of getting you. It's God letting us receive the outcome of our decisions, giving us what we ask for, and then allowing us to experience all of the outcome of that which we demand from him. Last week, we heard Paul anticipate then the objection. So if God's got wrath, then God's wrath is probably aimed at them there super bad sinners, whoever they are. And so Paul immediately goes after his own tribe, his own group of Christians, Jewish Christians, and he says, now listen, guys, there's no extra special slot for you just because you're Jewish. You don't get a one-up. You don't get to start, you know, 20 yards ahead. Like, God is impartial. He judges all of us equally according to the same measure and standard, which we think sounds great until we realize that that's not as great as we thought, because we all hope for a little bit of a grade curve with God. And so last week we thought about some of the groups that maybe we celebrate our being a part of too much and realize, oh no, God doesn't show partiality to any group. We're all going to be judged equally before God. Why? Because sin is all over us. And so today we're going to talk about sin, which I'm sure is what you hoped I would preach about. As we dive into Paul's explanation of this condition that's wrapped around our souls, I want you to listen to the words that he uses and do your very best to not do the thing that comes reflexive and natural to me at least, which is to point at someone else's issues. Especially if you call yourself a Christian in the room today, be asking yourself, God, what does this mean for me? So, Romans 3. Then what advantage has the Jew? Or what value is circumcision? Much in every way. To begin with, the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God. What if some were unfaithful? Does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? By no means. Let God be true, though everyone were a liar. It is written that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. But if our unrighteousness serves to show the righteousness of God, what shall we say? That God is unrighteous to inflict wrath on us? I speak in a human way. By no means, for then how could God judge the world? But if through my lie, God's truth abounds to his glory, why am I still being condemned as a sinner? And why not do evil that good may come, as some people slanderously charge us with saying? Their condemnation is just. What then? Are we Jews any better off? No, not at all. For we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin, as it is written, no one is righteous. No, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside, and together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood, and their paths are ruin and misery. And the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. The word of the Lord. Thanks indeed. We should pray. God, I don't like to dwell on my own sin. I don't like to think about it. I don't like to see the ugly parts of myself. I like, rather, Lord, to think about your grace and your mercy and salvation. God, I like to hear the promises. I like to think on heaven, not on where I should be. I don't want to think about judgment. My body reacts to it, Lord. But God, we must. Because good news is not good if bad news is not bad. So God, I'm asking that today, where our emotions or our mind or even our own bodies want to fight the idea that sin is real and devastating and dangerous, Lord, would you help us? Hold us back. Give us ears to hear and eyes to see, not just the danger and devastation of our own sinfulness, but God, the beauty and the wonder of your faithfulness to us. In Jesus' name, I'm asking you to do these things. Amen. I don't know if this came across your news feeds, but it came across mine, and so many times that I watched this over and over, it caused me to weep. This week, many of you probably saw or heard of the story of Brant, John, and Amber Geiger. Officer Geiger was sentenced to 10 years in prison for entering Brant's brother's home, both of them, and shooting this 26-year-old man, ostensibly because she mistook his apartment for her own. Now, everything about the story, if you followed it at all, is just super sad and tragic and just littered with sin. It echoes with all of the deep pain of our national struggle with the sin of racism as well. And so when many of you, like me, you saw a YouTube video, perhaps, of Brant forgiving his brother's killer. And preaching the gospel to her. And hugging her. And weeping with her. You might have wept like me. We saw a real life demonstration of what really costly faithfulness for this young Christian man looks like. To look past the sin of the person who took your brother from you and embrace her, that looks a lot like Jesus. And so I begin to reflect, like, why is this so touching? And why does it move us? Why did it move me? I can think of a few reasons. A couple of them really good. The emotional cost of letting go of deserved anger strikes me. And the forgiveness offered reminds me very much of the times that I have done really terrible things and been forgiven by others and, of course, been forgiven by Jesus for my sin. But as I reflected, I found something else that was less good. In addition to all those good reasons, I think I loved this story in some small part because I only got to see the hug and the tears and the forgiveness without feeling the loss of murder, injustice, and having my own life changed forever without my permission. I think I love to dwell on the good news, and I love to see stories of forgiveness, especially if I can skip past the bad parts and not feel devastated by them myself. And I think if we were to do this would be wrong. It was wrong for me. So I was greatly helped the following day, after the story went viral, to see this tendency that I have and we have to embrace grace, but try to avoid awareness of sin. To embrace the good news that, like, yeah, we're forgiven, and it cost Jesus everything, and it cost this young man a ton, and see the teary eyes of forgiveness, and we can all kind of clap at that, and it's like, it's good. It feels good to see and to hear. But if we try to embrace grace and avoid awareness of sin, then we will not be embracing grace. Because sin is too destructive and grace is too important that we allow ourselves to do that. So the following day, I actually was able to see a video of Botham and Brandt's mom, Allison. And I heard her words. I saw the faith that shaped her son's costly demonstration of faithfulness to the gospel that beckons us all forgive. And that same gospel that calls sinners forgiven also points out sin and all the ways we need to be forgiven and all the injustices we participate in and the sins we bear. So I'm going to quote her. This godly woman said, quote, "Forgiveness for us as Christians is a healing for us. But as my husband said, there are consequences. It does not mean that everything else we have suffered has to go unnoticed. You saw investigations that were marred with corruption," she said. "While we walk as Christians, we still have a responsibility to ensure that our city does what is right," end quote. I was struck by that. But what was going on in my soul was actually best put into words by a woman named Dorena Williamson. She writes for Christianity Today, and I would encourage you all to look up what she wrote. She writes this: "Listening to the entire John family offers us a fuller picture of Christianity. In their words and posture towards Geiger and the criminal justice system, we hear calls both for forgiveness and for justice. But if we elevate the words of one family member at the expense of another, we run the risk of distorting the gospel." And I could not agree more with what she said. I couldn't agree more. I see that same tendency in me. For the gospel to be the outrageously good news that Paul says it is, that we've been studying him just being excited about the gospel. If it's really good news, it cannot be the saccharine-laced half news that God merely forgives us. It's got to be the full-throated affirmation that sin, our sin, my sin, Adam Mabry's sin, is so very dangerous and destructive, and that God's faithfulness is so very surprising and wonderful. We can't say one without saying the other. I was reminded of that. I think Williamson, writing for Christianity Today, summed it up well. So I will quote her. "Brandt and Allison John are part of the same family. Both profess faith in Jesus. Their bold and powerful statements offer us an opportunity to stand with them both. We don't have to pick Brandt's call for grace at the expense of his mother's cry for justice." So at the end of this courtroom scene, we see a woman convicted of murder, convicted deeper of her sin and her guilt before the law of unjustly taking the life of an innocent black man. And many of you might be tempted to do the opposite of what I did instead of celebrating the forgiveness and mercy at the expense of the injustice. Maybe you'll be tempted to stare into the injustice and brush off the forgiveness and mercy. But don't do that either. The gospel tells us two things are true at once, and we have to be able to understand this. And I actually think that this is exactly what Paul is trying to get the Romans to understand. Two things are true at once. Sin is so much more dangerous and destructive than we allow ourselves to think it is. And God's faithfulness gives rise to forgiveness that is better than we know. Sin is so much worse than the things that we think it is. We laugh it off as an old concept. It's so much worse and so much more devastating. And at the same time, God's grace and mercy and forgiveness and faithfulness are wider, longer, higher, deeper, and more saturated with love than we've allowed ourselves to imagine. And that's what I want to communicate to you today. Paul gives us a passage of the Bible that many of us want to forget. We want the songs. We want to show up to church. We want to hear great stories. We want to be inspired. We want to have like good families, and we want to be blessed. But we don't want to know why that news is all that good, because most of us don't want to stare into the yawning chasm of our own sinfulness. I don't. You probably don't. Not many of you on your way to church this morning were probably like, I hope Adam does, like, goes real hard, hellfire, damnation. If you're that kind of person, you probably don't make it here much. I'm not trying to go hard, hellfire, damnation. I'm trying to be faithful to the Bible. And if we're going to see that the gospel of what God has done in Jesus Christ is the demonstration of his righteousness and power to save anybody, then we have to have an eyeful of the awfulness of our own depravity. And if we don't see it, and if we make excuses for it, and if we point to someone else, and if we play the yeah, but they did game, then we have no inheritance in what Jesus has done for us. And I don't want that for us. I don't want it for me. And so maybe this morning we could think about this passage briefly and see that sin is so much more dangerous than we imagined, and God's faithfulness is so much better than we expect. So in order to get there, I want to reverse engineer this text. I want to start at the second half, and then we'll end with the first half. I want to show you how Paul describes, by quoting the Old Testament. This isn't Paul just riffing. He's quoting his own Bible in various places, mostly from the book of Psalms, to relate to us how devastatingly tragic and horrible and awful sinfulness is, by starting and saying this: what then, are we Jews any better off? No. I'll say it like I said last week. There's no group you can be a part of externally that earns you grace and forgiveness internally. There's no right voting block. There's no right ethnic block. There's no right, nation. No. All of us get judged equally. And so, is it advantageous with regard to salvation to be in the right group? No. No. According to Paul, no, because we have all already charged that both Jews and Greeks are under sin. Think about that phrase, under sin. Under sin has to do with the fact that we are born subservient to a false king. Lots of y'all are having babies. Our nursery is blowing up. In fact, we now offer a nursery in the second service because some of you were taking that be fruitful and multiply thing super seriously. We appreciate that. Make disciples anyway, whichever way, both ways, whatever. Literally make them or go make them, whatever. If you're married, please, if you're okay. Sorry. Pastor Adam said, like, whoa, 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 whoa. Settle down, Turbo, settle down. Yeah. Some of you think you just found your ministry assignment. Let me pause that for you. Just hold up. If you're inclined that way, I'm glad you're here for the sermon on sin. So many babies, though. They're all really adorable. And every one of them are made in the image of God. Every one of them. Every one of you. So cool. That God puts his image in the world by putting us in the world. But you may find it also difficult to know, until you've raised some children, that every one of those children, those beautiful little babies, have a nature that is choked out by sin, like a python wrapped around its prey. Sinfulness is a condition that its victim cannot extricate himself from. We're under sin. We're under it. In the Gospel of the Old Testament is the story of the Exodus, and it's God defeating a false god king of this world. It's a whole big metaphor for us. We are born under the authority and lordship of a false god king. Our passport says evil. We are citizens of that kingdom. This world, sometimes the Bible calls it Babylon, sometimes the Bible calls it kingdom of this world, sometimes the Bible calls it our own flesh. Whatever the label, we're born under it. All of us, none of us, just because we're born in a better zip code or with a different color or with more money in the bank, none of us aren't born that way. All of us are born under sin. Jews and Greeks, which is Paul's universal language in this book. That is a critically important piece of theology for you to understand. And if you miss it, and if you reduce sin to doing bad things, then you will reduce Jesus to being a Palestinian psychiatrist who kind of, here's the prescription for, you know, do these nice things and then God will like you. No. Sin is not the bad things you do. Sin is the reason for the bad things you do. It is the part of your nature where simultaneously two things are true. You're made in the image of God and you are marred by sin. He goes on then to quote this long poem from the book of Psalms, telling us that sin is the root of all the evil in the world. This is a doctrine that we in our tradition of theological inheritance call the doctrine of total depravity. Okay, we stand in the heritage of the Reformation. Some of you look surprised. The only other options are Catholic or Orthodox, and that should be obvious. We're not those, right? We stand in the history of the theology of the Reformation. This starts by pointing out the supremacy of God and the tragedy of human depravity. What total depravity means isn't that we're all as bad as we could be. It means that every part of us, our mind, our bodies, our emotions, all of them are touched in some way by sin. All of it. My thoughts, my heart, every bit of me is experiencing the totality of depravity. Which is why he goes on to say, no one is righteous, no, not one, no one understands, no one seeks for God, all have turned aside, and together they have become worthless. The word worthless doesn't mean, in this case, like we have no value. It means that we're not doing our job. We are supposed to image God. We're supposed to be little pictures of deity walking around and making the world look like the heaven from which God sent humans into this place. But because of sinfulness, now we're not doing that well. We're broken. We're simultaneously capable of amazing, amazing natural wonders and world wars. Total depravity, dysfunctional image bearing. It's a devastating charge that the Bible levies at not them, at me, at you. Be very careful with your love of humanity. Humanity is easy to love. Humans, however, are very difficult. How can you say that about humanity? Humanity is amazing. You don't meet humanity. You live next to a human. Some of you with a human. Some of you are like, I know sin's real. Yeah, yeah. Total depravity. This means it's not just that we don't do what we ought to do. It's that we want to not do what we shouldn't do, and we don't want to do what we should do. In fact, we don't even want to know God. We can't know God. We can't want to know God. According to the book of Ephesians, also written by the Apostle Paul, we are dead in our trespasses and sins and in the ways in which we once walked, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who is now at work in the sons of disobedience, and we, like all of them, are objects of wrath, like the rest of mankind. Sin is so much more dangerous than we imagine. It's the root of all evil. And it's not just dangerous to you. I mean, we can have a long, here's what sin's done to me. There's all the ways sin is. And sin makes you dangerous to us. Remember a couple of weeks ago, I gave the analogy, like if I had a table up here and I put 100 Baccarat crystal wine glasses up here and I knocked them all off, I said, would they break? And you rightly said, yes, that is the correct answer. Now, let's say I gathered all the pieces in a box, and I called that box civilization. And then I shook it. shaking it. Do you think any of them would have come back together? Oh, what would have happened? The jagged edges of one glass would have broken the soft parts of another. And my brokenness does the same thing to you. What's broken about me tends to puncture you. And what's broken about you tends to puncture them. And on we go until we are fully disintegrated in our sin. That's what he means by the venom of vipers is under our lips. I mean, you've read a comment section anywhere on the internet, right? It could be about the most benign thing, like, here's a recipe for delicious blueberry muffins. Racist communist, like, whoa, 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 it's food.com. What are we talking about? And just all of human banality and evil. You just need to get 10 commas down, and you're like, I'm back away. I'm back away. I don't want to be part of this. Everywhere. A venom of vipers under our tongues, or in more common parlance, under our thumbs. Oh, some of y'all didn't like that. Yeah, sin, man. It's so much worse than we think it is. And its final effect is to do this. It says, there's no fear of God before their eyes. All right, Bible scholars. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So when you have no fear of the Lord, you therefore are a fool. Sin maroons us, therefore, into this ocean of our own foolishness, and we know not the way out. It's so much worse. It's so much worse than I can preach to you in the time I have allotted, which is why we're going to be here till 4. No. It's so bad. One guy, woo, I like you. I like you. We should hang out. It's so much worse. And so what some of you do when you hear just the horrible, devastating nature of sinfulness, you go, I know what I'll do. I will try harder and do better. Maybe invent a religion around it. Yeah, get some rules going, a book, a dusty leather-bound book. Maybe a building where we can all stand and sing in the same direction, feel really bad for ourselves after the first 45 minutes, and then remind ourselves to come back and try harder next week. Some of you are like, isn't that what we're doing? Gosh, I hope that's not what we're doing. That's called religion or paganism or 1,000 other things. We try to obviate our own moral bankruptcy by obeying in some other areas. Put up that image of a scale. We tend to think that our own judgment will work out like this somehow, right? Like, oh, I'm gonna get to the end of my days, I'm gonna pile all the good things I did on one side and all the bad things I did on the other, and go, I think you'll find, Lord, that though I did X, I did far more of Y. I'm a driver in Boston, which means I struggle with anger and impatience. I mean, it's part of the exam to get your license here. Do you struggle with anger? No, you can't drive. Right? It's kind of, we want a culture here in Boston. But I don't get a lot of tickets. But let's pretend like I've been driving, you know, all the years. I'm 37, so I've been driving for a while. Let's pretend like I'm driving, and for the first time, I get pulled over, and I break the speed limit, and the cop gives me a ticket, and I say, whoa, 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 officer, now, I think you'll find that for this many years, I've been perfectly lawful. So you can take your ticket. He would write me another ticket. One for being speeding and one for being an idiot, right? Like, I don't know, I feel like they can find a statute for that, right? And he should, because there's no amount of obeying the speed limit that makes my one violation of it not a violation of it. It doesn't work. Let me make it a little bit more real. To use our earlier example, there's no... Officer Geiger's going to go to jail for 10 years. She could go to jail for 10,000 years. That will not bring back the person that she slew. It doesn't work like that. So let's go back to the end of your days. It's not going to work like that. I think you'll find, Lord, please. You can't obey the law enough to deal with your disobedience to the law. All the law can do is go, this is the way you're supposed to live, and your one transgression of the law is the transgression of the whole law, Paul's going to say later. And so being a good guy most of the time, or being a good gal most of the time, won't get you right with God. It won't even get you right with traffic law. So what do we do? Well, it can't be undone by law. So what is law for? Well, we'll talk on this a little bit more later, but the law has some functions to it. We get to the end here and say, we know, verse 19, we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law so that every mouth may be stopped. And so the law can't save us. So why is the law there? Why are all 613 of these moral commandments in the book of Deuteronomy and later on, in the book of Exodus and later on in the book of Deuteronomy, plus the Ten Commandments, plus Jesus' two-sided summary of all of that, why is it all there? The first reason that it's there is to be a mirror to you. You look at yourself and you go, oh, no. To go, God is righteous and I am not. To make you aware of your own sinfulness. The second reason that the law is there is to curb human unrighteousness. Like setting up laws keeps us slightly less awful than we otherwise would be. Every couple of years, some well-meaning council person in some city, usually in America, says, you know what we ought to do? We ought to take all the laws that delineate things that are illegal and take those away, and there'll be less things that are illegal, and there'll be less crime. That'll work, right? And then a decade later, wouldn't you know it? That didn't work. Why? Because the law restrains us. And then for the Christian, the law can be a moral guide to help us think through ethical issues, which we'll talk about later in this book. But what it certainly can't do is ameliorate your sin or its effects. It can just point it out and make it worse. In fact, reading the Bible more will make you more aware of the manifold ways you can't obey. So let's read our Old Testament. Like, that's really hard. What do we do? Well, we said that sin is way worse than we thought, but God is faithful. Faithful, faithful, faithful. And so the purpose of the law, it says that those who are under the law are spoken to by the law so that every mouth may be stopped. The right response to you beginning to see God's moral commandments isn't to make you fight back or make you self-justify. It's to make you go, to make you silent. I don't know if any of you, when you were younger and your parents would point out something you needed to change, you would be quick with an excuse. This may shock some of you, but I was usually quick with an excuse. And I have created after my own kind. I know. It's like my very, very litigious genes found Hope's genes, put them in the closet, and I cloned myself with a host. So my youngest guy, my little guy, Wyatt, I love Wyatt. I'm telling myself that for me. That wasn't for you. That's for me. I love Wyatt. No, I really do. I love this kid. He's like the sweetest. I mean, just, I cannot wait to see the young man that he becomes. But he is Captain Yabut. Yabut. Hey, Wyatt, could you do Yabut? Hey, son, don't do Yabut. Ooh. So he's currently buried in my basement. No, I'm just playing. I'm just playing. Just playing. He went to kids' church today. We fed him. It's good. It's good. Everything's good. Wyatt's fine. Perfectly healthy. But we want to make excuses for our own violations of the law. And part of what this is designed to make us do is to shut our mouths and look deeply into our own unrighteousness. Don't deny yourself the gift of seeing your own depravity. For if you do, you will think yourself an historical outlier. Well, if I had been alive in, Germany in the 1930s and 40s, I would have stood against Hitler. If I had been alive, when Stalin was coming to power, I'd have been out there with a sign. I'd have stood against blah, 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 blah. Statistically, no, you wouldn't. No. Yes, sociologically, no. Theologically, definitely no, you wouldn't. No, if you imagine yourself to be the hero in every story of history and the hero in every story of the Bible, you are not reading either of those things as you ought. And neither would I be. We'd have been right there, man. God is more faithful than we expect. So, we read here, what value has the Jew? Good, much in every way. The Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God. Just because some were unfaithful doesn't nullify the faithlessness of God. But then he deals with this like anticipated, yeah, but. Yeah, but if God wants to demonstrate his righteousness and his grace through my sinfulness and my disobedience, why wouldn't I disobey more so that God could get more of an opportunity to demonstrate his grace? Yeah. Yeah. You've all seen that meme, right, where Batman slaps Robin? I'm just asking. Just wondering if you had. I've totally been that guy. I literally had this conversation with my youth pastor as a young man. Yeah, we're still friends. Why would God do it this way? And then he deals with our defeater beliefs. Some of you are like, well, why would God do this way? I would do history differently. Okay. Well, but you're not in charge of history, are you? Thankfully, you're not in charge of history. You maybe think it's unfair that God has let sin rampant, or maybe you feel that you've been victimized by sin. All of us have been victimized by sin to greater and lesser degrees. The scary news of the gospel is that we are, at various times, victims and victimizers. And if your heart's not ready for that, the gospel don't seem too good for you. Some of you will say, well, listen, Pastor Adam, look, we gotta keep the message positive. We gotta keep talking like about good things and, you know, keep blessing and all that good stuff. And boy, that just, come on, American evangelicalism. Hard eye roll. You don't find these anymore because they've all closed. Peace be upon them. But when Christian bookstores existed, you would walk in and you would see 9 books on theology and missions and then 2,785 bajillion books on Christian living that most of us didn't read. And they're all like, how to be better you, the youiest you. Squeeze the blessings out of the Bible. Some of you feel like you need to apologize for God's clarity about sin. I am not among you. God is super secure, and I don't need to make excuses for him as if I were his campaign manager and he were running for king of the universe and hoping for your vote. Nope. No. No. We cannot refuse to see the ugliness of sin. That is not faith. That is just self-deception. Others of you might be the kind of people who look so deeply into sin that you find it difficult to believe that God could forgive anyone or that we deserve it. We don't deserve it. And it is difficult to believe that God could forgive anyone, which is kind of why the gospel is a big deal. Because sin is so much more devastatingly bad than we have ever allowed ourselves to think. But God's faithfulness is so much better. Because in this passage, we see right here, if some are unfaithful and some disobey, does this nullify the faithfulness of God? No. God is always faithful. He has a relational credit score of perfect. He is doing exactly what he said he would do. In Deuteronomy 28, how many of y'all grew up in a good Pentecostal church? You love Deuteronomy 28. I'm blessed in the city. I'm blessed in the field. Organ hit. I'm blessed when I come, right? Come on. I feel you. I like that church. Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 14. Lots of blessings. Do you know what comes in verse 15 through like 39? All the curses. It's lots more curses. Way more curses. For disobedience. So listen, if you obey, this is coming at you. But if you don't obey, all this is coming at you. And it's a lot. It's a lot. We don't write songs about it. That's probably why you don't know. God's faithful to do exactly what he says he will do. He will bless those who are righteous, and he will not those who are not. And we are not. But God is also faithful to his promise to redeem us. You'll remember maybe in your Bible, Genesis 3, the first promise God made to redeem the world, to send a snake crusher, to defeat the enemy through the woman. Jesus. Jesus is that man. Jesus is the one who's come and demonstrated the faithfulness of God in his life and in his death and in his burial and in his resurrection. So this morning, I want you to get a big eyeful and a big earful and a big heartful of two realities that seem like they should not go together. But if you hold them in tension, then you will walk in virtue. And it is this: you are made in the image of God, and this world is a beautiful and wonderful and amazing place. And you are devastated by sin, and we are ruining each other. And every time we try to have one without the other, we make it worse. But here comes Jesus, God in the flesh, to live perfect human life, to suffer and die and be tortured and to be the victim of injustice and to be abandoned by his friends, all at the hands of the powerful here on the earth, to receive in his own body the wrath of God and take it down into hell and down into the grave, so that when he comes out again, he's free of all of those things, because he was not actually the one guilty of all of those things, so that he could offer to us who are forgiveness. Simultaneously, God demonstrating that he is faithful to bless the righteous and faithful to take injustice seriously enough to destroy it. And in Jesus' own destruction of his body, God put the false king of this world on notice and offers to free those of us who are born under his rulership. So if you've been born again into a living hope, if you have a passport that says Kingdom of God on it, if you've been baptized and you lift your hands and you call yourself a Christian, then you must see that sin is devastating and it is dangerous. And God is faithful and he is wonderful. For you, I simply ask, don't play with sin. Just don't. Oh, it's just a little porn, it's just a little lust, it's just a little too much to drink, it's just a little bit of cosmos-destroying rebellion. It's not good. Don't play with it, man. Just don't. What starts with dislike blossoms to hate and ends up making murder possible. What starts as a second glance grows into lust, which ends up making rape and pornography and child sex slavery and on possible. What starts with ambition too much turns into greed, which makes injustice abound. Come on, don't play with it, please. One of my favorite theologians in the Reformation, a guy named John Owen, said it more succinctly than I can, so I shall quote him: be killing sin, or sin will be killing you. But don't play. For those of you who aren't yet followers of Jesus, my invitation is for you to meet Jesus and come to know Jesus, because there's no one like Jesus. And if you can hold these twin truths in your head, that sin is worse than you thought and God is more faithful than you imagined, then you will get the gift of being virtuous. You will walk with the virtue of prudence. You will have a right relationship with reality, because you will see that you have every reason to be an optimist. We win in the end, but you have every reason to be a realist. Humans are pretty bad. This week we got to see a real demonstration of the gospel in the news. You don't see it often, which is why I brought it to our attention. We got to see a victim and a man with every right to hate and judge lay down that right, because his king laid down that right for him. Don't let the good vibes keep you from also getting an eyeful of the injustice which made this so beautiful. And let this teach us something. That sin is so bad, and it's breaking everything, but Jesus has come to make all things new.